unified and more equal in terms of its power politics. It's one of the ironies of globalization that it has really made the world more fragmented, more regional, and more dangerous. In many ways, it's a kind of creative destruction in global politics, just as creative destruction and entrepreneurialism have changed almost every aspect of the business and personal landscape. We were perhaps foolish to think that it wouldn't happen in the realm of global politics, as the institutions, infrastructure, and architecture that America made in the post-war period is now under review and up for grabs. We're going to talk about this very different world with my guest, Ian Bremmer. He is president of the Eurasia Group. He's a columnist for the Financial Times. He blogs for Reuters and Foreign Policy and has written for the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Newsweek, and Foreign Affairs. It is my pleasure to welcome Ian Bremmer back to this program to talk about his newest work, Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G-Zero World. Ian Bremmer, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Delight to have you here. Explain first what a G-Zero World is. We just witnessed the G8 this week. What is the G-Zero?
Well, it is a world where the United States is not prepared to provide global leadership, whether it's on bailing out the Europeans or removing Assad from power in Syria or leading a global trade or climate deal. But it's also one where no other country or group of countries are going to do it either. And as you said in the opening, it's a creative destruction of geopolitics, and it's one we really haven't seen for decades.
One of the things you talk about is that in spite of all of the things that have happened in the world, including 9/11, that it was really the 2008 financial crisis that was the tipping point that got us to this G-Zero world.
Well, it's been coming for a long time. I mean, if you think about the shift in the underlying balance of power between the United States and China, or between the developed and the developing world, or the debtor and the creditor states, I mean, this has been coming for 30 years. Just a radical imbalance of who controls what compared to the way that the world's institutions and architecture actually functioned. But still, nothing. It wasn't going to break until you had a shock. I mean, it's like you're out on a pier and waves slam into it. The pier can be a little bit rickety, but until you have the big wave, you can still stand on it. Well, the wave that turned out to hit us that was big enough was the 2008 financial crisis.
Is there anything that the U.S. might have done during these intervening years that might have created a different kind of world, that might have built into place some of the architecture that might have helped us going forward as opposed to where we are today?
Well, I think given that the values are so different of the United States with the new emerging powers, I mean, our political systems are different. China's an authoritarian state. We're a liberal democracy. The economic system is different. China's a state capitalist economy where the state is the principal actor. We're a free market economy where the companies are principal actors. These developing states are poor countries. We're a rich country. Our allies are rich countries. I mean, the differences are huge. So it's hard to imagine that we would have been able to put in an effective group that would have included, truly included, these countries with very, very real and different interests than we have. But it certainly is true that the United States might have spent more time developing effective coalitions of the willing. When we think about the term coalition of the willing, we think about wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But in reality, we need to do much more of that on the economic front, too, on the trade front, on climate. We've had all of these global summits on climate that are worthless. Copenhagen, Cancun, Durban. How many times do we need to keep spending time meeting with every major country in the world and accomplishing nothing as the underlying problem gets bigger and bigger? The United States needs to have a coalition of the willing on climate or on trade or on monetary policy that brings the U.S. together with other countries that actually agree with it and that will be capable of doing something. It may not be the ideal solution, but the best possible solution should be the one that we're working towards.
One of the things that we've seen in all of this, and maybe one of the things that we've missed and has been part of this creative destruction, is that there was in the old world a closer nexus between the politics of the country and the economics of the country. There seems to be less of that now. The politics and the economics are not always connected in the same way.
Well, that's certainly true in the United States, right, where on the one hand you have serious gridlock in Washington, and you have, on the other hand, this extraordinary entrepreneurship that drives the U.S. economy and builds the new thing better than any country in the world, and no one else is close. And in part, that's because the developed world is not created to do a lot of governing. It's really meant to have, you know, sort of a balance of powers, the politics of faction ensuring that no one consistently has the upper hand. The whole notion of the government that governs best is the one that governs least. Well, if we believe that, the U.S. should be doing really well, because there's not been a lot of governing coming out of Washington recently. But in a period of crisis, in a period where you're being challenged by other governments that have competing economic systems, you actually need to govern more effectively. And we're seeing that the U.S. just isn't set up well to do that.
And China really is the antithesis of that, where there is this authoritarian government, but yet all of this activity in terms of the business and private sector.
That's right. I mean, the Chinese system is in so many ways incompatible with the U.S. system. And look, we need to be able to work with them. It's important to have as good a relationship as possible, because these are the world's two largest economies. But it's a real challenge, because for the Chinese system to continue to work the way that its leaders want it to, they need to preference Chinese state-owned enterprises and privately owned national champions. They need to ensure that a larger piece of the pie goes to them. They need to get technology for themselves. And that's going to necessarily squeeze out a lot of Western multinationals that have taken the lion's share of the profits from their businesses in China and elsewhere for a very long period of time. This is really not an area where the interests of these two countries align or coincide, and that's going to be a problem.
One of the things that you talk about is how, again, in the creative destruction model, that it is the developing world that is able to move more easily, almost like startups, in terms of navigating this landscape.
The developing world certainly has the capacity to be longer term in the way the governments act. If the Chinese want to continue to build nuclear power plants after Fukushima, they can do it. And if that's efficient, that's great. And they don't have to deal with, you know, sort of an outcry of people saying, well, what if nuclear is dangerous, right? If you want to build a road and there's a village in the way and you're China, you can do it. Now, not every developing country can do that. The Indians certainly can't, right? I mean, very decentralized, much more localized corruption. Hard to make that stuff happen. And India's been left behind in terms of growth compared to China over the past decades as a consequence. But ultimately, the Chinese system is not efficient. It works really well in the near term because they take advantage of very cheap capital. But when you look at state-owned enterprises in China and compare them with the private sector in China, the profitability that comes from these state-owned enterprises, even given the access of cheap labor and cheap capital, is dramatically lower, on average over 10% lower. 14% on average for private sector, less than 4% for the state-owned sector in China. Over the long term, as Chinese labor gets more expensive, that just isn't going to work.
One of the ironies, coming back to the beginning, is that globalization has made the world more fractious in many ways, more regional, more broken up than one would think.
It's much more fractional and broken up. I mean, for so many years, we had a U.S.-led global economic system, and that meant a single currency, it meant a single trade regime, it meant our multinational corporations had single standards they could work in globally. That's the best possible world for private companies to operate. Doesn't mean everyone benefits from it. Certainly there were a lot of people that got hurt. But from a pure private sector perspective, you like that. Well, so Facebook just had an IPO. It's supposed to be worth, what, $100 billion now, right? There are 500 million plus Chinese on the internet that have no access to Facebook. And it's because the Chinese are creating a different internet, right? That's not globalization. That's fragmentation. And you will start to see that on telecommunications with different 4G standards, You'll see it on currencies over time. I mean, so many different ways you will see that the global economy will no longer look like a single process of globalization, of trade harmonization, and all the rest. And that is absolutely going to be a more problematic environment for growth.
And a more problematic environment for global multinationals that try to grow, because they have to adjust to a very different kind of world in this regard.
Yes, they do. Those that are unprepared to adjust are going to experience very serious problems, because it means that it may not, in many sectors, it may not be that you want to have be one global company. It may mean that your regional operations need to look increasingly very different from each other. You need to sell completely different things. You need to align with governmental policies in different parts of the world, which is, you know, not an easy thing always to do. And for, in some sectors, it may mean you need to be not global. If you're in the aviation sector, the military industrial sector, the energy sector, it may be increasingly that there are some places that you just won't be able to play, because state-owned enterprises in those regions will be too powerful and too problematic. What they'll want from you will undermine your entire model. So you'll need to adapt and be much more nimble, and be very different in the way you think about how you structure your corporation.
And the nimbleness of nations that are able to, as you say, pivot between different regions and different parts of the world, that those are going to be the winners in this global landscape.
Oh, I think that's clearly true. I mean, in the U.S.-led globalized world, all you need to do as a country was align yourself with that process. In a world where there isn't global leadership and where integration happens very differently in different parts of the world, if you're a country, you want optionality, you want a hedge, you want to be what I call a pivot state. There are a lot of countries that pivot well. Canada pivots pretty well. If we decide we don't want to build that Keystone XL pipeline, the Chinese would love to do that, right? The polar ice cap melts, Canada's going to have shipping lanes that bring them closer to every country in the world. That's very useful for them. Indonesia pivots very well between the Chinese and the United States and other countries. Turkey, between the Middle East and Russia and Europe, and the Caspian Basin. There are other countries that don't pivot well. Mexico doesn't pivot well. Taiwan, Ukraine. Increasingly, your ability to play the field as a country, it matters an awful lot, because you're not just looking for growth in a G0 environment. You want growth and resilience. And resilience requires that level of flexibility.
What about sophistication? What about political sophistication in being able to navigate this world?
Well, politics are mattering much more in the global economy, not only in domestically in emerging markets, but also when we think about how geopolitics are in play for both countries and companies around the world. If you don't have a strong capacity to understand what different governments want from you and how those rules of the road can change, you're going to have problems. And the short-term perspectives of many that are in the U.S. markets will hurt in that regard. You know, I saw a survey taken by PwC a few months ago of global CEOs that said that 30% of them believe that the country that was most important for their success in the next 10 years was China. Only 22% said the United States. Frankly, that's ridiculous. The level of volatility and uncertainty and exposure to China over the next 10 years is immense. It's so much greater than that of the United States. Not only does the Chinese economy need to continue to succeed, which means they must effectively rebalance their political and economic system, which has never been done at that scale, but it also means that you need to be in a position to benefit from that success. Both of those are very uncertain propositions, but it has to do with the short-termism of CEOs and of shareholders in the U.S. system, and that benefits us greatly when it's all one system led by the U.S., but when it's not, we end up in trouble.
Brazil is sort of the ideal example of a country that's able to pivot well and has the political sophistication.
They do have the political sophistication. You know, you see so many emerging markets where the first leader comes in and then after that and does a great job, and then, you know, after your Mandela moment, it becomes more sclerotic and corrupt. Actually, you know, Dilma Rousseff, the Brazilian president, if anything, is doing a better job in tackling corruption and being pragmatic on the fiscal side than Lula did. They have extraordinary resources, offshore and onshore, oil and agriculture. They've got strong demographic growth. The bureaucracy is pretty capable and is improving all the time, and everybody wants to invest there. The problem with Brazil, frankly, is that it's such a well-known story that it's becoming expensive. And if you look on the Economist's Big Mac Index, after Switzerland, the second most expensive Big Mac in the world is in Brazil. You know, it's a little toppy right now.
What happens to the existing institutions, things like the World Bank, the IMF, the G8, etc.?
Well, you know, in my view, we are no longer in a world where U.S.-led global institutions will work. So we have to make a choice. We can either have U.S.-led institutions that aren't global, or we can have global institutions that aren't U.S.-led, right? So when you're talking about the G20 or the World Bank or the IMF, the United Nations Security Council, we have to decide how big we want them to be. We can have them be coalitions of the willing. They can be smaller. And if they're smaller and they have like-minded countries in them, they can do a lot. They can get a lot done, but they won't be at the global level. And that's kind of what the U.S. is doing on trade with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. It's not global. It's not the Doha Round. It's not the WTO. But it's a smaller group of countries in North America and across in the Pacific that actually share fundamental values and economic political systems with the U.S. Or the U.S. can say, no, we want it to be global. But then then these organizations will be big and unwieldy. They will accomplish much less, even though they're more inclusive, and the U.S. won't lead them. So the U.S. is going to have to make this decision.
In many ways, trade is kind of the harbinger of how this structure has to work and the kind of trade deals that we have.
Yeah, there's no question. And I do think, and I spoke with a lot of European leaders before the G8 summit this weekend who told me that they would love to see a transatlantic partnership, a U.S.-EU trade deal that would make a difference in terms of growth without requiring a move away from the budget austerity that so many of these countries have to commit to. And, I mean, you know, when you think about Germany and Audi putting $1 billion into a plant in Mexico because they have a free trade agreement and they won't go to the U.S. because it's just much more expensive, you have to ask yourself, well, why are we doing this? And it's going to be hard to do because it's complicated and there are agricultural lobbies and other lobbies that want protectionism. But ultimately, a way for the U.S. to win is to develop much more efficient trade pacts with countries that do fundamentally agree with the way the United States structures its economy.
Where does Europe fit into this G0 world?
The Europeans are relatively well integrated and governed. It doesn't feel that way today, but certainly compared to other regions of the world. And if there isn't global leadership, regions will become more important. And I think that ultimately this period of instability in Europe will make them stronger. It will lead to better governance. We are seeing a fiscal compact that the Eurozone parliaments have agreed to. It's not ideal and it's not fiscal union, but it moves towards more effective governance. And certainly the level of austerity that we've seen from many of the European peripherals in the past 2 years has helped to make them more competitive over the long term. Certainly in Italy we're seeing that right now, which is the biggest of those economies.
Uh-huh. Where are the flashpoints right now, the places in the world where this kind of regionalism and lack of leadership, even within regions, can produce potential conflict?
Well, there are two in particular. One is the Middle East, and if you look at the Middle East today, the only country that has a definably positive trajectory is Tunisia. That's pretty disturbing. You see the wars that are breaking out all over this place. Yemen is ungovernable. Egypt has a problematic transition. Syria has a civil war. It's starting to spill over into Lebanon. The list goes on. Iraq is worse with the U.S. troops having gone. Absent any international leadership, the countries that matter in the Middle East are Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Turkey. But all three of those have completely different preferred outcomes, Sunni, Shia, or secular middle class. And that means that you'll see more proxy fights across the Middle East than a G0. In Asia, the problem is that China drives the economic integration, but the United States drives the security integration, and these countries are increasingly going to bump up against each other. It's going to be harder and harder for countries across Asia to continue to balance between those two, to continue to be pivot states.
As nature abhors a vacuum, to what extent will we see new leadership and new institutions emerge? It may take, as you talk about, 5, 10, 20 years. To what extent will a new architecture evolve out of this?
Oh, it absolutely will, because if there's no architecture, that means you're going to continue to have global problems that will not be responded to effectively, and the problems will get bigger and bigger. Eventually, you'll get something. The question is what that something is going to be. And it depends in large part on really two different questions. One is, what's the U.S.-China relationship? Is it harmonious or not? The world's two largest economies. And then the second is, how much do other countries matter? Do they matter a lot or a little? Does Europe get its act together? Is India a real player globally? Japan, on and on. And you know, depending on your answer to those questions, you'll see what kind of leadership you get, what comes after the G0. So far, you'd probably make a bet that U.S.-China is going to have a more conflictual relationship for reasons we've talked about. And the second is that other countries are likely to matter a lot, and that's in part a bet that Europe does not fall apart. And if both of those things are true, then you're going to end up with a world that will have much stronger regional organizations and institutions. And that won't just be in the case of Europe. You'll see regional architecture that develops across the world, much more regional trade deals, people starting to deal with climate in a more localized way, dealing with security in a more localized way, sometimes effectively, sometimes very ineffectively. It won't be as ideal from the American perspective as the world that the U.S. dominated from World War II on, but it's hardly a disaster.
Ian Bremmer, the book is Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G0 World. Ian, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.